From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much for doing that. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On January 3rd, an incredible number of prominent self-described evangelical Christian leaders gathered in Florida to start the new year with prayers. Prayers for what? For peace? Healing divides? The love of Jesus Christ touching more hearts? No. Their focus was on the launch of Evangelicals for Trump. Yet one more outrageous step toward idolatry of a polarizing political leader. And there were many examples of resulting talking points, with just one example coming from televangelist Jim Baker. Trump is a test whether you're even saved, declared the disgraced ex-convict. Only saved people can love Trump, he continued. At the gathering itself, the president blurted out the assertion that, quote, God is on our side. His rambling hour-long speech included the promise to restore prayer to the classroom and generous attacks on all things Democratic with a capital D, and I dare say, Democratic with a lowercase d as well. Confidence indeed. Meanwhile, a small but growing movement of evangelical Republicans who find this betrayal of faith unacceptable and calling themselves the Lincoln Project have launched their first powerful web video called Mega Church. The Lincoln Project's foundation statement is simply, if this is the best American Christians can do, then God help us all. And here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Imposing our faith on others. We call it religious freedom. We, the majority religion, are free to choose that religion. And everyone else is free to make a big fuss over the one we chose. By repackaging prejudice as liberty, religious freedom is a magical backdoor to that happier time before civil rights.
Thursday is National Religious Freedom Day. Although the political religious right continues its shrill hijacking of our founding freedom in purely sectarian and self-serving terms, there are signs of hope that Americans are beginning to see through that tactic, with news on that front ranging from hashtags to state lawmaking. We'll get a briefing from Political Research Associates Fred Clarkson.
I always felt closest to God when I was in nature, and I always loved just being able to kind of get away from the chaos and really submerge myself in that environment. The idea of climate change was very taboo, and if it was ever brought up, it was honestly just mentioned and kind of written off as a way that the world works, and it's just the cycles of weather.
The enormity of the environmental challenges facing our planet are escalating month by month. But responses that take humanity's role in the crisis seriously are multiplying as well. And on this week's show, we'll get an update from Kyle Mayard Schapp of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. But first,
the president tweeted that, quote, all is well.
Our missiles are big, powerful, accurate, lethal, and fast. Under construction are many hypersonic missiles.
We live in an incredibly complex age, even as public rhetoric and policy suffer more and more from gross oversimplification. This tendency played a central role in America's post-9/11 war-making in the Middle East. It has determined election outcomes, and it has helped polarize Americans one against the other. Now, childish black-and-white arguments are being made to justify the extrajudicial assassination of a sovereign nation's second-in-command and to beat the drums of war yet again in the Middle East. For a more adult conversation about these critically important topics, I am most fortunate to be joined by the Right Reverend John Bryson Chain, retired Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C., and probably the leading practitioner of interfaith diplomacy with Iran in the entire United States. Bishop Chain, my good friend, I can't thank you enough for being with us today.
Well, Welton, it's good to be able to have some conversation with you today. When we talk about people who have been doing unbelievably excellent interfaith work throughout this country and beyond, you're one of the leaders, and I think everybody who's been engaged in this kind of work knows that. But for those who don't and who might be listening, they should understand that.
You've been a part of sensitive, nuanced, sophisticated international conversations and negotiations for decades. You know so well the dedicated, selfless diplomats and others who work tirelessly for peace and mutual understanding around the world. In light of all of this, John, when you heard about the sledgehammer action by the arguably least informed world leader of our lifetime, what were your thoughts and, if I may ask, what were your prayers?
When the news came, it came to a place where I really couldn't respond except to sit down here with my wife, and we opened up the Book of Common Prayer. We said our evening prayers that day, calling for a compassionate response and a way in which to end divisions in this country so that we could be respectfully engaged in living with one another and look at the world in a very different way than, unfortunately, that response would indicate. That was the first response. The second response was to then pull it together and feel a great loss, since there's been a lot of what we would call back-channel work ongoing since the election of President Trump now 4 years ago.
When did you get so interested in Iran and become so close to people there?
That's a fascinating story and an excellent question. I had never been to Iran before. In 2005, I was approached by the Iranian intersection in New York City with a request that Washington National Cathedral host a presentation or a discussion with former President Khatami. I had never met him, and the way in which we work as a country in countries that we have defined as bad actors, former President Khatami was in residence at the residence of the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations. But in order to get beyond a radius, I think, of some 30 miles, there had to be special permission granted by the State Department for President Hatemi to come to the cathedral to speak. I thought it would be fascinating, given the fact that we had been living through the great traumas of the takeover of the U.S. Embassy and the imprisonment of 52 of our members of staff. And so this might be a great opportunity to open up that conversation. Called a friend at the State Department, it's not going to happen, that we will not permit that. I did have a friend in the White House who was very close to then-President Bush and asked if the president would intercede. A lot of people would have thought, President Bush isn't going to want to take that walk, but he did. He phoned back to my colleague and friend and said permission is granted. And so that gave us the opportunity to have President Hatemi come to speak at the cathedral. He also wanted to speak at the University of Virginia. He wanted to speak at Harvard University. He also wanted to speak with a large Shia population base, I think in Michigan. That being given, he came, and there were many, many protesters outside the cathedral threatening to burn themselves, self-immolation, because he represented a bad side of what they considered to be a free country. And so the security was unbelievably tight. As we were leaving the cathedral after his address, and his address was really about the relationship between Oriental religions and religions that we would call Western religions, which was a fascinating presentation. I'm sure that some people were looking for something very exciting, but this was very deep. Oriental and Occidental theologies and the discussion of that was really something that was very much in my mind. As he was leaving, getting into a limousine surrounded by all these security people with masks over their faces and with automatic weapons, because there were so many threats against me and my colleagues at the cathedral, death threats, and against former President Hatemi, that the security was unbelievably tight. But he turned around and looked at me, and we had dinner before he spoke. He spoke very, very good English, and he said, I would like to invite you to come to Iran, and unfortunately, you will probably not receive the same kind of welcome that I have received in visiting your country, and so I'm so grateful. He said, we will make a contact with you through our ambassador to the UN and arrange for a visit, but you must come within the next several months. So that opened up the door. Mm. I'll end that by just saying that I went to the State Department and had a colleague there who was also a good Republican, and said, I'd like to sit down and talk to you about Iran. And he said, we don't have any information about Iran. I said, well, can I use a credit card? No. What about my currency? No. All of the things were no. And then they said, we have not had conversation directly with Iran since 1979. Mm. So they said, but wait a minute. New York staffer came in and they said, can you get some information on Iran for the bishop? He came back 5 minutes later, it was a printout from, what is it, The Lonely Planet? I forget what the title of that is. But you could find it on the internet. It just talked about the generalities of the country. That's all we had as a country on Iran and its people and its culture. And the request was, when you come back, assuming you will come back, would you meet with us? So we went over and spent, I think, 10 days in fascinating meetings at every level of the Iranian theocracy, political leadership within the parliament, and also had a great opportunity to take time to look at some of the greatest cultural sites in the world.
From that time, you know the Iranian people so well, and I'd like for you to talk, if you would, about the impact the killing of General Soleimani in Iraq had specifically on the reformers and advocates of democracy that have worked so bravely in Iran in recent years?
It has placed a tremendous burden on their shoulders, a burden that has was extremely difficult to bear, given the sanctions that the United States government put on Iran, with the failure to accept and work through the P5 plus one nuclear agreement that had been worked on very hard by their foreign minister Javad Zarif and also John Kerry, Secretary of State, and also other members of the Obama entourage. The promise was, and I was there just before that agreement was signed, and people in the shops were so excited about the possibility of the country being able to be a part of the economics of the Western world that they were driving down the street honking their horns. I was hugged by people, and I'm dressed up as a bishop, so they know exactly who I am and where I come from. And so it was very hopeful. President Rouhani, who was eventually elected as president, came on board and sold this opportunity to the Iranian people. And there was the theological content that, of course, we are not in the business of enriching uranium to create a nuclear weapon. It's against our theology. And you've already met with the Supreme Leader. You know that's, in fact, at least the thinking and where we are as a country. So this absolutely was devastating, and it put a huge burden on people who have worked so hard to open up conversation and, I would say, free trade with the West and a hope for the people who had been really stung by these sanctions.
John, so overall, does this unite many factions in Iran in a way that moves things in a more dangerous direction?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I hate to be kind of negative by saying I would say so, but there are supporters of the former Shah or the regime who are in this country and elsewhere. MEK, which was labeled as a terrorist organization by previous administrations, not just the Obama administration, but previous administrations, has been taken off that list of terrorist organizations. And they have been very active. They have created violence in the country against the regime. I remember talking to a number of these would just be folks in Iran because we have free access to travel there, who would say to us, is your country ever going to go to war with us if things don't get better? Will you bomb us? I mean, these were horrible conversations with shopkeepers and just folks that I would meet in the lobby of the hotels where we were staying at during our visits. But what they said was, we may not necessarily agree with the regime at this point in terms of our political process. It's kind of messy, but so is yours. Yours is just as messy, we think, as ours is. But if ever there should be an attack against our country, as much as I might disagree with the administration, I will tell you that we would come back if we have friends in L.A. and in Chicago. I mean, it's huge Iranian communities. We would come back to defend our country. We love our country. And people in the United States, I think, would feel the same way about their country if it came under attack. So make no mistake about it, even if we disagree with the policies of our government, we love our country, and we would come and fight for it.
John, you have worked with so many reformers and activists in Iran. You've been with the highest leaders in Iran. You've also met with leaders there who were openly hostile to the United States. How have you been able to walk that incredibly fine line?
Well, it's not been easy because I was criticized in my own House of Bishops and by the conservative media in the United States as being Iran's favorite Ayatollah in Washington. And it hasn't been easy on my family either. I think, though, that one of the things that's so important about these dialogues that have occurred and continue to occur is a respect for the other, a knowledge and developing relationships with folks, finding out that there is commonality, not only from a theological point of view, which is something I think a lot of people don't really understand, but also in terms of art and culture, sports. Back during the Bush years, visas were granted for academics. Once we opened up that door through our first visit to Iran, we had art shows of photographers and artists from Iran at the cathedral. We had visits that were arranged for academics to attend and teach quarter semesters at George Washington University, George Washington University, Georgetown University. We were able to host youth events that were exchanges. And so there was this openness, this ability finally to communicate with one another, artists and academics and religious leaders. Mm-hmm. That was really exciting. It was the opening of a new day many of us felt had come. And unfortunately, with a change in administration, bad things have happened. And I just want to end that part of it with saying I was in Tehran at the fourth Christian-Muslim summit, which was being held. In this case, it started in Washington, it went to Beirut, then it went to the Vatican in Rome, it ended in Tehran. And we were in meetings in Tehran at this summit when I was summoned outside by a grand Ayatollah who took me by the shoulder and said, "I need to tell you that we have just received word about your election for the President of the United States." And I was shocked. None of us could believe it. There were three of us from the delegation from the United States, others from Great Britain and Hong Kong and wherever. And he saw that I was shocked, and he said, "Now you will know what it was like for us to live with Ahmadinejad for 8 years."
Boy. In addition to the incredible harm our policies inflicted decades ago, how has the West now inadvertently helped the current regime consolidate power?
Well, the current regime in Iran, in specific, has been under President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, in particular, have been hanging on, I would say, under great pressure on occasion from the Supreme Leader. If you remember, Javad Zarif tried to resign his position almost a year ago and was asked to stay on. He was so depressed with what had happened in the United States, but also was under a great deal of pressure from other elements, conservative elements within the Islamic Republic. What has kept it together, I think, has been the sanctions that have been put in place on the Iranian people by the current administration in Washington. Sanctions really hurt people more so than governments, and in this case, it has really hurt the Iranian people, and so it has, in a sense, muted some of the backlash of ultra-conservatives in that country, some clerics and others in the parliament. So we're dealing with a different ball game. There's been a lot of stuff that's been back and forth over the years since Rouhani's been elected. But this has been a way of keeping a more unified country and government that's more unified than it has been in since Rouhani's election.
Inevitably, as Washington sets the already tense relationship with Iran on fire, it multiplies the risk faced by Iranians who may be seen as pro-reform and international in engagement. Would you talk about those risks?
Well, there's great risk. I mean, I was notified by a colleague of mine who worked for the State Department for many years, who said to me, you need to be very careful about the emails that you send out or the phone conversations you have with colleagues that you've worked with, are working with in Iran, and vice versa. There are moments when the tension is so great between our two countries that conversation literally just stops. I mean, they're afraid to be in conversation with us, or I'm afraid that at some point the FBI is going to come knocking on my door. They've done that in the past when I was in Washington about Mr. Levinson, who was apparently has disappeared and is considered to be a prisoner. But I mean, it works both ways, I guess, Welton. And right now, it's very difficult to open up conversation, although we have had conversation with our contacts in Iran just prior to this latest incident, mm-hmm. the killing of the Iranian general. And we're hopeful that we can continue to keep those lines of communication open, even as the administration places further sanctions on the country for having dropped missiles into those two air bases in Iraq.
So how big a setback are these developments for the cooperation and communication that has been happening outside the spotlight?
We're not sure. To be honest, I've been in touch with the Iranian ambassador's office to the UN, which has always been a great place to be able to sit down and have frank conversations. We are hopeful that we will be able to bring together people who have been engaged in interfaith, interreligious work together to meet with the Iranians, if for no other reason to communicate to them that the position of this administration does not necessarily reflect the point of view of the American people. I think the American people were shocked when the president, just as a matter of happenstance, said that cultural sites would be part of the 52 targets that were identified by the president to be sites for rocketry and bombing. Mm-hmm. And there, I mean, for the most part, people in this country said, you have to take, that's crazy, that's a war crime. Mm-hmm. But to the people in Iran, it's they're fearful. They are very fearful that can happen and would happen.
Were you surprised by what happened? And am I correct in assuming that this administration didn't bother to take any steps in advance of the assassination to ensure the safety of our partners and allies within Iran?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The option to, as the administration would say, take him out, mm-hmm. Was always on the table, given the fact that he was a very powerful person. His power would be almost equated to the supreme leader and also to the authority of the foreign minister of the country. Revolutionary Guards are a complex organization. But there was no warning that an action like this would take place. I think it literally caught the Iranians off guard from what I know. It caught our allies, who are very critical to this equation in Europe, off guard. It put them in a very difficult position. It caught members of the United Nations. It caught them off guard, and it caught NATO off guard. It was kind of like a gunslinger's action walking into a town to clean it out. I mean, it was really very much unexpected. And when it did happen, all conversations between colleagues in Iran ended. Although we still have been in some somewhat closer touch now.
Of course, John, young Americans are deploying to the Middle East in a ritual that portends nothing good for the region. We've seen in the past how once our forces are in place, it becomes much more tempting to use them. How worried are you about escalation?
Well, right now, I think, as the president has said, Iran is in a position of standing down. But the region is so volatile, and I think people have to understand that the great challenge here is that the challenge is the role that Saudi Arabia will play in the region in terms of being a power center, and the role that Iran will play. It's interesting that Iran is, for all of how we see Iranians on American television, are the best educated of all of the countries that are defined as the Middle East or the Levant. Mm-hmm. Education is free for men and women, although they do have private universities. Women have equal access to education. And many of the scientists, as we all know, and many of the leaders in Iran were educated in the United States in American universities. We used to have this crossover. A lot of their engineers and a lot of their scientists were educated in the United States at some of the greatest universities in our country. And so you have Iran, which can be a gigantic economic engine. It has significant supplies of oil, large supplies of oil, is located in an interesting environment, but they're surrounded by countries with nuclear weapons. I mean, Israel has them, Turkey has them, Pakistan has them, and you have the split between the Sunni and the Shia Muslim traditions. And that creates an environment of, you know, pushing and pulling about who is going to control the region. You can see it played out in Yemen, and who's going to survive? And then you have positions taken by the American government regarding the West Bank and relocating our diplomatic presence and declining Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, that creates this unbelievable tension based on past history, religion, economics, all bound together by fear of the other. And I think that's where religion becomes very important, because the theologies, the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam share so much in common, mm-hmm. besides just worshiping one God, that one can come to a table with all of these competing elements, even the most conservative, and make headway. I remember when we were in Iran negotiating finally for the release of the three hikers back in 2011. And I was sitting in the holy in a setting in the holy city of Qom, and surrounded by very, very smart and very, very conservative Iranian clerics and theologians, saying, why would we do this? Why would we release these three men when you have 28 of our people being held in the United States under federal custody for sanction violations? What is it? Why do you think we should do this? And I just looked at him and said, I'm not here to argue about who my Jesus is and who the prophet is, although there are so many similarities, it's painful. The common denominator in these conversations has to be compassion, mm-hmm. which is bearing the burden of the others and seeking forgiveness. And if we cannot come to a place where that is the playbook, then we're not going to get anywhere. Nobody's going to be released from prison, and we're not going to have any deep conversations about how to resolve the differences between our two countries. So theology does play a great deal in being able to bring conversations to a level that you would never get at the diplomatic level.
Well, I know I don't have to tell you that we are facing a lack of empathy and compassion in the high positions in our nation right now. And that's one of the things that is scaring me. I want to ask you one other rather negative question, and then I will get off of that. But when politicians as prominent as Nikki Haley, parroted by numerous Republican attention seekers, are willing to lie shamelessly about Democrats' response to the death of Soleimani, what hope is left for any kind of coming together around our true best interests as a nation?
Well, again, I think it's really tough because that's a tough question, and we also hear it too from Iran. And I have to say that I've had some pretty intense conversations some time ago regarding Iraq, but I must say that it makes it so difficult to move the needle anywhere above top dead center, to make opportunities available for high level conversations to occur. And the bottom line is the point of it is, and we worked on this issue with Brookings too. I used to go to Doha. I was there for 3 years in a row for the U.S. Islamic World Forum.
I was there with you two of those.
Exactly. That's right. And, yeah. And so you know what that was all about. We were moving forward, trying to build a base that would bring interreligious leaders from literally around the globe to really create an environment that would be not so much a pressure cooker, but would begin to talk to people in their communities in different parts of the world, and especially in the United States. You need to understand that these people are not demons. I mean, you look at these people and you see people who are dressed all in black with hijabs, and you see these mass demonstrations, and you see death to the Satan, the great Satan. And in the old days, when I would go to Iran, you'd see pictures of the supreme leader looking, he would be scowling, or you would see right out near the Evin prison, there would be pictures of bombs dropping from airplanes on Iran. People had painted it on the walls. The last time I was there, the ads now, because there was this real hope for an opening in their economy, were about buying commercial goods like automobiles, jewelry, clothing. I couldn't believe it. I went from Tehran down to Ayatollah Khomeini's tomb to worship there. We were invited to worship there with our Iranian colleagues. And the signs on the by the side of the highway were certainly not anything like I had seen in the past, because the people were feeling that there was hope, that there would be a different way of living. But people who do not know what they're saying, or are trying to take a party line that the government wants to be spoken about, really have no understanding at all about what it's like. I keep saying to my wife, I don't know how many of these people have ever been over to Iran and spent time with Iranian people, eating with them, talking with them, praying with them. I mean, going to the great library. They have one of the most beautiful libraries in the world, just outside of Tehran. Unbelievable. Ancient Christian texts. They took us down there to share some of these holy, holy books that we would remember as early Christians. We just... It's sad. I mean, my heart breaks. It really does, Welton. I wish people would get off of the the blame game and the lie game, and we get on to the real game, which is finding mutual respect and the opportunity to begin to exchange once again with members of the clergy, with academics, artists, civil society, students, etc.
I am right with you there, and I actually said to you the other day, I fear that so many Americans see Iranians as one group of people, all alike, all somewhat devilish. And you know, and I know, the diversity of the people in Iran is there just like there is diversity in the United States. And one of the things I wanted you to talk about, because it's so important, is help us understand who the Iranian people are. I don't know. You told me you had a story that you wanted to tell me about the Iranian people that would be very helpful, and I don't know what that was, but I want to hear it if you still remember it.
Yeah, I don't know how helpful it'll be. It was my first visit to Iran, and, you know, when I go over there, we get into conversations, and I always say, my Jesus. You know, they can talk about Muhammad, and they will say, well, Jesus was a great prophet. But I will say, you know, that's okay. You know, that's the way in which you come to connect with God. My Jesus is the way in which I connect with God. We can debate the issues. But anyway, so I'm over there, and I'm in a cassock, a purple cassock, and I've got my pectoral cross that came with the office of bishop in Washington. And I'm in a car, a limo, going back to the airport after this second visit that I was in Iran, very, you know, not knowing how I'd be received being dressed like that in this country because of, you know, what I always believed Iran might be like when it came to Christians. Mm-hmm. I wanted to stop off at a little souk, a little bazaar, to pick up some souvenirs for my grandkids, mm-hmm. and my wife, because they do great artwork, metalwork, just enamel work, phenomenal. So the driver said, no, I will take you in and I can negotiate the price. And so we did that. I bought the stuff, and they were taking me to the airport to fly home to Washington. And it's about 5:30 or 6 o'clock at night. We are right literally in the center of Iran's traffic. And traffic in Iran is just, you can't, it's unimaginable. So there we are. I'm just about ready to get into this limousine, and a woman comes running down the sidewalk shrieking in Farsi with two younger girls, probably 18 or 19, shrieking with her arms up in the air. And I said to the driver, I don't speak Farsi, and I don't think she likes me, and let's get out of here now. Because and people were stopping. I mean, people literally were stopping the cars to see what was going to happen. And he looked at me, and he said, no, no, no. He said, she knows that you are a Christian, and she's calling to you to bless her and her two daughters.
Hmm.
And I said, if I do that in your country, I'm going to go to jail, right? And he said, you know, Bishop, we all worship the same God. We respect Jesus as much as we respect Muhammad. And this woman is asking you for a blessing.
Mm.
And nothing will happen to her or you.
My goodness.
This woman came up to me, knelt on her knees on the sidewalk with her two daughters, with people gawking during rush hour in Tehran. And I don't speak Farsi, so I just said a blessing in English. He translated it. She stood up, was in tears, gave me a big hug. The girls, her daughters, gave me a big hug, and they turned around and walked away.
Mm-mm.
And as I get into the car, we're driving to the airport, and he said, Iranian people do not hate Americans, and they do not hate Christians. We all worship the same God. We are just as much like you as you are like us. Please tell your people that.
My gosh.
But that was just limited understanding of the country, limited understanding of what things, what I could do and what I couldn't do as a Christian and, and as a bishop in that country. And that opened up a lot of, for me, that opened up a lot of windows for conversation and discussion with my colleagues at Tehran University and also at Ayatollah Khomeini University in Qom.
We've talked politics, we've talked policy, we've talked about people. Before we end the conversation today, I'd like to talk about faith and values. I know your empathy, you've already mentioned that, understanding and outreach spring from the teachings of your Episcopal tradition and that you have spent a lifetime studying the shared humanity and sacred worth of people from very different backgrounds. So from that perspective, I'd like for you to speak about the week's events from that perspective in those terms.
Well, it's from a human – from just a human response, it was very difficult for me. This is a horrible thing to say. I began to judge the leadership of my country now, and people I'm sure who might be listening to this will be just not happy with it. I would say, how in the name of God could anybody do what we did, which was an assassination, if they were a follower of Jesus, as I try to be, and broadly speaking, as a Christian? What motivates people to tell lies that are irrefutably lies, and what drives a country which we have said is one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, a country that's based on this great experiment of democracy, that believes that it is, in a sense, for better theology or worse theology, a nation that was brought together under the gift of the very God that we all worship. How in God's name can we do what we do? And what we have done in the name of our democracy and in the name of our God. Now, there's blood on everybody's hands. But I just kept saying, how can we justify this when we have other opportunities for dialogue? One of the great gifts, you know, I don't want to preach this, but one of the great gifts of Jesus' ministry was his ability to engage in conversation and dialogue with people who were not like him whatsoever, whether they, especially women. I mean, his ministry was a ministry of embrace and dialogue. It was not one of rejection and not wanting to engage. And the fact that we are willing to use violence as our way of engagement as a country today is heartbreaking. The one thing that keeps me going every day is my belief that, one, there is a God. This God is a God who created this universe and created Iranians, Americans, created this gorgeous world we live in. And the expectation is we would be great stewards of one another and of the earth that we've been given. And we don't do that. We don't. It must make God weep, as Bill Coffin would say. There's a great book called Exclusion and Embrace by Miroslav Volf, who is a Yale professor. And it's kind of deep. It's a theological exploration of identity, otherness, and reconciliation. But I remember Desmond Tutu is a good friend, and Desmond was saying, we were in South Africa some years ago. Desmond said, you know, when we were going through the whole process of reconciliation in South Africa after what had happened in apartheid, he said, the bottom line is, he said, I cannot be who I am without you being in my life. And you cannot be who you are unless I am in your life. If we are not connected in that way, then there is very little hope for us to do what God would call us to do. And I've thought about that a lot. This is not a very good answer, but it just keeps me going at a time when I feel very alone. There are not a lot of people who do this kind of work for a lot of reasons. You're one of them that does it. But it is lonely work, and it's you get criticized. I'll close with this. I mean, I was at the National Cathedral preaching several Christmases, the second Christmas before I retired. And I started it off by saying, isn't it unusual that God would choose the angel Gabriel to not only confront Abraham, but also communicate to Moses God's word and commandments? Isn't it unusual that God would choose the angel Gabriel to announce the coming of the birth of Jesus? And isn't it unusual that God would choose the angel Gabriel to address the word of God through the prophet Muhammad? And if you read the Quran, you read the Old Testament, you read Christian scriptures, the angel Gabriel is mentioned as that interlocutor to these three great Abrahamic faiths. And so, I mean, you read your texts and you wonder, how can we do these things to one another? So it's lonely, but I'm hopeful. You know, I wake up and I know that when the sun goes down here, it's coming up in Iran, and there are going to be better days ahead. And if we can just keep working hard at it, keeping the lines of communication open, and respecting the other, even in difficult times, we can see change.
The Right Reverend John Bryson Chain served as the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C. from 2002 to 2011. In addition to his denominational leadership, Bishop Chain has dedicated himself to global interfaith dialogue and study with a particular focus on Iran dating back for decades and thankfully continuing to this very day. John, it has been a pleasure and a privilege to work with you over these many years. And as disappointing as some of the self-inflicted challenges our nation faces today on the world stage are, it comforts me to know that you are still out there, still offering a voice of reason and of moral imperative for a time such as this. I respect you. I care for you. I love working with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
And thank you for all that you do to feed me and so many others to continue this work, because you are a blessing as well.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show as the political religious right prepares to celebrate its twisted version of religious freedom. A movement to reclaim the language of our first freedom is gaining momentum. We'll hear from organizer Fred Clarkson. And later, an update on the growing Young Evangelicals for Climate Action movement with Kyle Mayard Schapp. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Political Research Associates senior researcher Fred Clarkson is a frequent guest around here, and with good reason. His deep knowledge of corrosive theocratic movements in our country, like Project Blitz, makes him an invaluable resource, as does his activism in defense of a more honest interpretation of our constitutional first freedom. As the political religious right prepares once again to bend the National Religious Freedom Day on January 16th to its own self-serving purposes, there has actually been progress on the front of reclaiming this language and this cause on behalf of all Americans. And so I'm happy to welcome Frederick Clarkson back to State of Belief for an update. Fred, thanks for being with us again.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Welton. It's good to have your voice out there.
You know, I have great memories from my time in Washington, D.C., when on Religious Freedom Day, we often gathered at the Jefferson Memorial to celebrate what some people say is our best contribution to the world, and they're talking about religious freedom. Briefly, what's the history of Religious Freedom Day, and how do you consider it to have been under assault in recent years?
Well, the basic history is that back in 1992, Congress, in their wisdom, declared Religious Freedom Day to commemorate the enactment of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. It was authored by Thomas Jefferson in 1777, fresh from having authored the Declaration of Independence. So that was like the first thing he did when he got back to Virginia. It wasn't ready to for prime time at that point, but prime time came in 1786 when James Madison shepherded it through the Virginia legislature. And the and then he went on to Philadelphia to be the principal author of the Constitution and leader of the First Amendment. So the Supreme Court and historians think that this really is the taproot. This is like the authentic core of what the founders, the framers of the Constitution, were thinking about the proper relationship between citizens and government and powerful religious institutions. So it's that important in that way. But today, you know, most of us have kind of forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. We take religious freedom for granted. And many of us, we not only not know the history of this vital part of American democracy and world democracy as we understand it, what we strive for. When we talk about freedom, this is the core piece. But the Christian right has not, and they understand what a threat it is to the authoritarian and theocratic ideas that they hold. And so they've tried to hijack the idea for their own purposes, as you were saying, particularly in the area of what we call religious exemptions or refusals, and that as idea, the idea of having in being able to invoke one's religious conscience to not abide by the laws that apply to everyone else. For example, bakers who don't want to bake wedding cakes for legally married gay couples, or people who don't want to, or health workers who don't want to be involved in providing medical services that in any way might be involved in contraception or abortion, or even providing mental health services to LGBTQ people. It's a real corrosion in recognizing the rights of all.
I know that you're working in a coalition. Who all is working with you?
The Project Blitz Coalition, it's quite a broad group. American Atheists is one, so is the Interfaith Alliance. So is the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice and the Freedom From Religion Foundation. People are not formally a part of the coalition that we have, but are working with us in other ways are like the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. Mm-hmm. So it's an expanding area of interest and concern about creeping Christian nationalism and dominionism on the one side, but an effort to really reclaim the roots, the history, the meaning, and the authority of religious freedom.
Fred, you've written a comprehensive report on Religious Freedom Day 2020, published in Ethics Daily. Talk about the legislative inroads made on this in the past year, if you would.
In response to efforts by Project Blitz to commemorate Religious Freedom Day in a way that would be supportive of the Christian right view of religious freedom, we arranged to craft one that would be authentically commemorative to the Jeffersonian intent and the historical significance of the Virginia Statute. And so with the collaboration of historians, we crafted a model resolution of our own. And last year, our pilot project had passed in the D.C. City Council and was introduced in the Minnesota State Legislature by State Senator John Murray. And this year, it's taking off again. Several major national organizations, the Baptist Joint Committee, American Atheists, the American Humanist Association, and others, have been trying to take it to their activists and say, you know, let's begin to really reclaim this. So I do know that, well, we'll see what finally happens, but I do know that the mayor of Pittsburgh, William Peduto, has issued a mayoral proclamation for Religious Freedom Day based on our model, and very recently the governor of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, has also done the same. So we'll see how it goes. It's kind of slow going, as you know, Welton, to get people to change what they think and what they do. So to really take back Religious Freedom Day as a commemoration is slow going, particularly in these complicated times. But what I'm seeing is very encouraging.
Fred, I think it's smart to work on two fronts, and that's what you've been doing, legislatively on the one hand and organizing, raising public awareness on the other. Let's talk about the social media component of this run-up to Religious Freedom Day on this January 16th.
3-4 years ago, when we were really first embarking on this idea about reclaiming the idea of religious freedom, partly because an awful lot of interest groups were reacting to the Christian right and saying, well, religious freedom is not that. It's not discrimination. It's not, and you can't, you know, use religious freedom to justify discrimination. Well, of course you can. They were doing it all the time. But we needed to say, well, what is religious freedom? And so the first thing we could get people to do, a big national coalition, dozens of national religious and civil rights organizations and secular organizations started a social media campaign on Religious Freedom Day under the hashtag Religious Freedom Is. And it really took off. And I think in the first year we had 6 million impressions on Twitter. And so we're doing it again this year, and so we will take our Twitter messages and tweet out our op-eds like the Ethics Daily piece that I wrote and see if we can do a little consciousness raising that way.
I know there are people listening to us who are very interested in what we're talking about and who want to be supportive. Some of those people are saying, but I don't live in Washington, D.C. So what is the specific way that people, wherever they live, can take part on this day?
Well, one thing is to participate in the social media work. If people go to blitzwatch.org, they'll find some resources around Religious Freedom Day. And if they just go to the hashtag on Twitter anytime, you know, last year's tweets are still there and the new ones are already arriving. And again, it's hashtag Religious Freedom Is. And you can access that from anywhere in the world.
What do you think the next steps need to be in rescuing the language of religious freedom from the theocratic religious right in this country?
We need to be conversant with this bit of history. At least that's the approach that I've taken. When we begin to think about, you know, religious freedom, you know, is not just for me but for thee, right? Mm-hmm. We begin to, there's a lot more us and we about what it means because we're all religiously so different. Our rights are the same, even as our views are very different. So learning how to think about navigating our differences and embracing respectfully those differences and insisting on our equality under the law is a different way of framing these things. Instead of saying, well, as a Christian, I have the right to do this. Well, you might, but, you know, so do Muslims and Jews and atheists. And we have to, you know, temper our language in a way that's thoughtful and respective to the very difficult task of religious pluralism. You know, if religious freedom, the right to think differently from the rich and the powerful and the monarchists and the theocrats, you know, is in fact the taproot of democracy, the first part of the First Amendment, you know, if you can't think differently from the powerful, you certainly can't speak freely or, you know, write freely either. So without religious freedom, we don't have democracy, and we need to really embrace that and know it in our bones and begin to be able to articulate it as if that were so.
You know, Fred, I still meet some people who think that religious freedom really does just have to do with, I don't have to go to church if I don't want to, or I can go to whatever church I want to go to. I think it's important for us to stress the breadth and depth of religious freedom in almost every phase of our democracy. Talk for just a second about what all kinds of issues come under this religious freedom concern.
Well, certainly, you know, the contemporary issues that we hear about in terms of access to services, like we're seeing religious exemptions in state and federally funded adoption and foster care agencies, where if you are of a particular religious tradition, usually some form of evangelical Protestant, it's okay to discriminate against gay people, but it's also okay increasingly to discriminate against Catholics and Jews. They only want to serve their kind of Christian, their kind of religion. We certainly see it in areas of abortion rights, access to health services, so many issues of separation church and state involving the public schools, you know, where there's prayer in the school kinds of things, or in God We Trust issues, placards being pasted on the walls of public schools. That's an affront to, you know, the non-religious and people who believe in God differently or more comprehensively than a government slogan pasted on the wall. We're seeing it just arrive everywhere. But I want to say about that, it's not Religious Freedom Day, and religious freedom is not really about religion, right? It's about Jefferson and Madison used the term, and the Founding Fathers used the term, that was the term of the time, but they also meant synonymously, and they often said this, it's about the right of individual conscience and the freedom of the mind. So the idea of thinking freely, you know, and changing your mind is what religious freedom is. It's not just about thinking about God or gods. It's about being able to have the rights under the law that your mind will be respected and supported by the government.
Religious freedom is our first freedom, and it is at the foundation of all of our other freedoms. Fred Clarkson is Senior Research Analyst at Political Research Associates. His groundbreaking work exposing the nationwide Project Blitz theocratic campaign has led to effective organizing among more moderate voices of faith and facilitated the founding of a coalition-sponsored website, blitzwatch.org. We'll link to his Ethics Daily article headlined, Why You Need to Know Our North Star of Religious Freedom, from stateofbelief.com. Fred, thank you so much for your important work and for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Wilson. Always a pleasure.
Almost exactly 2 years ago, we first brought you the story of the group Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. It's high time for an update, and I am pleased to be joined again by national organizer and spokesperson, Kyle Mayard Schapp. Kyle, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with a little background on the organization. Not everyone heard us the first time around. How did it get started, and how did you get involved in this work?
Sure. So Young Evangelicals for Climate Action has been around since 2012. We were started really out of a recognition that for a lot of us who grew up in the church, there wasn't a natural connection between our faith and our relationship to the natural world. And for a lot of us, we had been studying this either in school or digging into the scriptures and recognizing that actually our faith has a whole lot to say about God's creation. And specifically, one of the greatest current threats and moral challenges to God's creation, which is climate change. So we got started because we wanted to bring the unique voice of young evangelical Christians into the public square around this question. And I got involved soon after the organization was founded. I came onto the steering committee in 2013 and stepped into the leadership role that I'm currently in 2016.
Where was the inspiration for you?
For me, it started actually with my brother. So my brother is a few years older than me. I really look up to him, still do, and certainly did in 2010 when he came back from a trip to New Zealand. It was a semester study abroad where he studied at the intersection of ecology and biology, as well as biblical studies and theology, kind of weaving together these themes in scripture about God's love for the world and our call to care for it. And he came back just totally transformed. And he shared that experience with me and began to open up this new worldview for me, really, of recognizing the call in scripture to love God and love our neighbor by making sure that we're caring for God's world and making sure our neighbors can flourish in God's world. And from there, it was lots of study and experiences of my own, going to different regions in the U.S. and around the world, witnessing what environmental destruction is doing to people, to my neighbor, who I'm called to love, and just kind of snowballed from there.
Well, I'm eager to know how it's been going. Has the movement been growing these past 2 years since we last spoke? Because the crises have certainly been multiplying across the globe.
Absolutely. Absolutely to both of those statements. We have been growing, and I think it is in no small part because the headlines continue to bear out what we already know, that if we continue with kind of the status quo without making significant efforts to reduce our emissions, then, you know, apocalyptic wildfires like we're seeing in Australia are only going to get worse. Wildfires in California and Montana are only going to get worse. Hurricanes in Florida, the Caribbean are only going to get worse. So I think it's served to really kind of mobilize and galvanize a lot of our generation to say, look, the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report says that if we do nothing by 2030, some of the most catastrophic impacts of climate change are going to begin manifesting themselves. We're going to be in our 30s and 40s, our generation. That's a lot of life left to live in a world that's a lot less predictable, a lot less safe. And we recognize that not only is this a call from our Savior to serve Him better, it's also a call to safeguard our futures and to make sure that ourselves and our children have a livable world.
Well, Kyle, talk about how organized religion has been responding to you. Has organized religion stepped up on the climate crisis?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of different pockets where we're seeing faithful response from people of faith. I mean, clearly the easiest example that most people have heard of is Pope Francis's encyclical Laudato Si and the Catholic Church's response to that. But we're also seeing lots of other denominations stepping up and speaking out and taking action Many, many denominations across the U.S. have a statement on creation care generally and climate change specifically. Many of them have committed resources to helping their congregations learn about the issue, learn about why it's a matter of faith for those of us who follow Jesus Christ, and learn about concrete, practical, faithful solutions that we can all get behind and work for. In 2015, for example, the National Association of Evangelicals, the largest umbrella organization for evangelical Christians in the U.S., came out with a statement that said, "We believe that climate change is an urgent moral challenge that requires action from evangelicals in the United States." So we're certainly seeing congregations, denominations, leaders, including in the evangelical church, stepping up and saying, look, this is a moral issue. This has to do with how we love our neighbors. This has to do with how we respond to God's call to us to take care of the good creation that he loves. So yes, we're certainly seeing churches stepping up and stepping out and taking action.
Could you tell us one or two particular successes that Young Evangelicals for Climate Action has been able to organize in recent months?
Yeah, certainly. I would say that one of the most exciting successes that we've had is we've had significant recognition of the success of one of our programs, which is the Climate Leadership Fellows Program. This is a program that targets college students across the country, and it convenes them together for a training, helps them learn about the theology of creation care, the science of climate change, the policy of climate solutions, as well as techniques for effective organizing, resources for grounding our work in our faith and drawing from the rich Christian tradition that's there to pull from. So we train them all up together, and then we set them loose on their college campuses, some of them in their church communities, to carry out action plans that range from educating their peers on the issue of climate change, to engaging their administration, to engaging their local elected leaders, and kind of everything in between. And, you know, we've had fellows who have gotten solar panels erected on their campuses, fellows who have built relationships with their members of Congress who said, you know, this is the first time I've heard from evangelical Christians that this is an issue that matters to them. And for the coming year, we are growing that program by 400%. We're going to have 35 fellows across the country who are going to be working on their campuses with their elected leaders, with their church leaders, trying to bring this issue to the fore more successfully and on a broader scale than ever before.
Do you find pastors encouraging young people to be aligned with you and working with you?
We certainly have pastors who are excited about this, who are sharing these opportunities with young people in their congregations. I think, you know, frankly, a lot of pastors still feel reticent, maybe a little afraid to engage kind of wholeheartedly in this discussion because it is so emotional. It's become so polarized and so partisan for so much of the country. And so I certainly recognize and I understand that fear. But I think I would just say to pastors, you have so much influence in your community to lead sensitively, to encourage faithfully, especially when it comes to your young people. A lot of the young people we work with have very similar stories that tend to follow they tend to go something like this. I heard this in church very rarely or never before, and I took that silence to mean that this didn't matter to me as a Christian. And then when I started learning about it myself, I had to do a lot of work to make peace with the silence that I experienced in my church. Pastors have so much power to flip that narrative, to change that, to help young people begin to think critically about how their faith integrates with this issue. So we certainly have pastors, lots of pastors, who get this, who are on board and supportive, We can always have more.
What kind of inroads are you making in terms of education of young people, whether in creating curricula or directly speaking to school groups?
Yeah, so we have terrific relationships with dozens of Christian college campuses across the country, most of whom are a part of a body called the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, which is a great partner of ours. And it's meant that we have been able to get on to dozens and dozens of Christian college campuses across the country, physically get on campus to lead chapels, to lead lectures for students and community alike, to get into classrooms, to guest lecture in a religion course, to guest lecture in a biology course. So we're doing lots of direct engagement that way. We also have thousands and thousands of unique visitors to our website every month who are engaging resources that we host on our website. We host an online training that is an opportunity for young people to receive very similar training that we offer at our fellows training that I mentioned before, mm-hmm. online and at their own pace. So we try to offer lots of different opportunities for young people to be educated, to get trained up so that they feel equipped to be leaders on this issue in their communities. And we try to make sure that the opportunities are accessible to everybody regardless of capacity.
What other groups are you collaborating with?
Yeah, so there's actually a pretty exciting growing body of evangelical creation care organizations. There's Climate Caretakers, which is doing very similar work to us, but focused on Christians more broadly, not necessarily young people. We partner often, obviously, with our parent organization, the Evangelical Environmental Network. They are very supportive of our work, and we're always looking for ways to do more work together. And we're also partnering with lots of organizations that are outside of the Christian space. I think one of the exciting parts of the work that we do is that we fill this really unique niche where we are truly part of the evangelical community, and we have relationships in churches and among church leaders. Well, we're also part of the climate movement in the U.S., and we have relationships with other organizations who are doing climate education and policy work, but not necessarily from a faith perspective. Yeah. And it's exciting to see those relationships grow on both sides, because I think historically there's been suspicion between those two camps. And to be able to bridge that divide and help evangelicals understand that, look, the climate movement wants what you want. They want clean air, clean water, and a stable, healthy future. Mm-hmm. And to help the climate movement recognize that, you know, the evangelical church is filled with good people who get that this issue matters. They just might have different motivations for doing it than you do. It's really exciting to be able to bridge that gap and to build understanding in that way.
You've mentioned some of what's ahead. How would you like to see the organization grow in 2020?
Yeah, great question. So we're really excited about the work that we have planned. In addition to growing the Fellows program, we're also hiring some part-time field organizers in strategic regions. All of this is on our website, yecaction.org. We have lots of exciting plans. I think I would love to see a groundswell of young Christians be motivated by the opportunity that we have in 2020 to really bring this issue into the forefront of the national consciousness. Lots of people are talking about climate change more than ever, and I think young Christians have outsized power to be messengers in their churches, in their communities, for why this issue matters to people of faith. We're seeing anecdotally in our campus visits, in the number of visitors to our website, in the growth of our programs, we're seeing that there's a hunger for this among young Christians across the country. We're seeing that there's the potential for a groundswell of engagement among young Christians on this issue. And I think we're building toward that. And it's my dream that 2020 might be the time when we really see that come to fruition.
So tell our listeners how they can learn more about Young Evangelicals for Climate Action and how they can be supportive.
Absolutely. So the best way to learn more is to go to our website, YEC for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. So YECAction.org. We're actually right in the middle of a website rebuild. So hopefully if you log in the next couple of weeks, you'll see a fresh website. It's even easier to navigate than before. We're on all of the social media channels and platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you're not a young person, which is 18 to 30, as we define it, share the website, share this radio session with young people that you know who you think might be interested. And as always, we are always interested in partnering with people who want to walk alongside us financially. There are opportunities to give on our website as well.
Kyle Mayard Shep is national organizer and spokesperson for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. Kyle, let's not wait 2 years before we talk again.
I agree. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. You can do it on social media. You can do it in person. You can have someone sit down with you and listen to us. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.